is 1 Corinthians 1, 18 through 31. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many powerful, not many of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, in order that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. So I really worked for a while on the title of this sermon. Last week was a sermon about the idea the book of Corinthians about the cross as being a net, as something that weaves together the unity of a body of Christ out of a diversity of different strands. So I started working this week on the idea that the net is a trap. Or for my Gen X friends, do you want the blue pill or the red pill? But in deference to Admiral Akbar, the final title of the sermon is, Trey, it's a trap. Okay. This is a passage that's very self-consciously directed at the church in Corinth, as I described it last week. It's a church, not unlike ours, that was small. It was surrounded by a religious and a general culture that wasn't always willing to listen to the message that it had to bring. On one hand, the early church in Corinth had this difficult relationship with the Jewish community around it. They had held to the idea that what it meant to be a person in the line of God was to be related by blood, by birth, or by ethnicity to the nation of Israel, and that what it meant for you to be a devout person would be to hold on to the traditions of Israel, and in fact that God's promise was for those exclusively who followed the traditions of Israel. And you can imagine, for the small church in Corinth, as a little subset of that community, they were in a difficult position as people who seemed to be breaking with everything that was meaningful in the tradition. And of course, if you know anything about the larger Greek culture at the time, it was a culture where that would have thought that this small group of believers was naive, that it was bound to a mythology that didn't best represent good secular and philosophical reason. The Greeks of the time would have prided themselves on being people who thought with a kind of common sense and reasoned by using the best tools of philosophy to come to know things. So here's this church in Corinth. It's small. It's kind of torn between two different factions. Remember last week I talked about the idea that it was also in a difficult relationship with the elements of the Christian church that wanted to teach that Christianity was a form of Gnosticism. Everybody remember about Gnosticism? It was a way of thinking about faith that said that faith was ultimately about becoming a member of a very small sect that allowed you over time and by initiation to access the mysteries of the gospel. Gnosticism was, as I characterized it last week, kind of ancient Scientology. You went up in levels over time and you got initiated progressively into the secrets. And so here, the small church that wants to grow is in the midst of this culture that on all sides has a significant disagreement with them. They were worried about the relationship with their city too. They were worried about the relationship with tradition. They were worried about ignoring common sense. And think about it. I mean, you can think about the angle from tradition, and it's easy to see. We have talked about this as a theme time and time and time again at Resurrection Church, and I imagine eventually we all will get tired of it, but the tradition out of which Christianity grew held Israel and Israel's chosen people to be bound by a promise through blood to God, and they understood their goal to be the bearers of tradition. So the community would have been opposed against religious tradition in a really weird way. And common sense, it's even worse. I mean, for the Greeks, the essence of wisdom was the idea that you should live well to be happy. In fact, when we say the term someone is living the good life, in the end, we're borrowing an essentially Greek concept about what it meant to be a good person. For the Greeks of the time, the way to be a good person would have been to be ethically sound, to be mentally sharp, to be learned, and to be physically fit. The Greeks understood life as, instead of preserving a tradition like the Jewish communities did, they would have understood you living your life as literally performing yourself as a work of art. Your goal would have been to make yourself ethically and mentally and physically beautiful. And then you would have pursued that by pursuing common sense. In fact, like I said, the kind of whole of Greek living was that you cultivate individual existence, you cultivate beauty for the sake of achieving happiness, and that's where common sense and reason come from. Now here's the thing, here's where Paul's in a really interesting kind of position. He's writing this letter to this small church, and he wants to tell them they have to reject this Greek notion that life is about common sense and reason and beauty. They have to reject the Jewish notion that life is about living out a tradition, and they have to reject this Gnostic notion that what it means to be a good Christian is to be initiated into secrets that were hidden. And so Paul writes this letter, and basically one of the things I love about this letter is the beginning of it is just this kind of blazing, all-out assault on the ways that we think about our lives, tradition, common sense. Basically, it's Paul going in guns blazing on all the things that make sense out of not only the life of the people in Corinth, but that in very real ways make sense out of our life. Paul doesn't hold back. He rolls in and he says, look, tradition is bunk. Tradition is bunk because it represents the human appropriation of the truth of God. Tradition is the mirror through which we can only see darkly. And common sense, it too is bunk. Why? Because Greek common sense was about becoming more excellent yourself, becoming more beautiful yourself, about living a good life, about living a life that matched with the basic underlying beauty of the cosmos. And against that, Paul suggests that the ultimate truth of history is not about common sense, it's not about beauty, it is about something that is ugly. It is about something that is incomprehensible. It's about the cross. Think about it. There's a start of this passage that sounds like the weirdest setup for a joke ever. A rabbi, a Greek philosopher, and Paul walk into a bar. The punchline's not very funny, though. It's shocking. You think the tradition, beauty, or common sense can be orienting principles of a well-lived life? And Paul's friends say, well, yeah, of course. I mean, he believes in tradition, he believes in beauty, common sense, and reason. And Paul interrupts them, and he says, the infinite, all-powerful, eternal God of the universe became finite and died. A simple Palestinian carpenter did so to establish himself as a model for God's wisdom. He died on a cross, the only innocent man. And by the way, he was killed by folks who had a commitment to tradition and a commitment to the commonsensical view that maintaining order is important. Everything you know is wrong. By the way, does anyone want a beer? For the message of the cross, Paul says, it isn't just foolishness. That's one of those places where we translate the Bible to make it polite. For the message of the cross, Paul says, is stupidity to those who are perishing. But to us, it is who are being saved, it is power. And the Greek word here is dunamis. It doesn't mean power just like plugging in. It means the literal principle or capability that allows everything to be remade. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom. And I'll get back to this. The word here is sophian, of the wise. And the discernment, the Greek word here is sunesis, of the discerning, I will thwart. See, he's identifying two kinds of wisdom that in the Corinthian context would have been the main orienting points. Those who claimed that they had wisdom, Sophian or Sophia, and those who claimed that they had discernment, Sunesis. And we have Christian versions of these words, so it seems like a weird passage to us. But I want to unpack just a little bit what Paul would have been talking about in that Greek context. Sophian, wisdom, and Sunesis, discernment. They represent two ways of relating to the world. Put in a slightly more nerdy tone, they represent two modes of epistemology, two ways of engaging how we know, understand, and interact. Sophia represents the tradition of wisdom. Sophia is a vision of knowing things that sees wisdom as something to be chased after, to be grabbed and possessed. Annabeth's been reading a lot of Greek mythology lately, and she'd probably tell you that when the Greeks thought about Sophia, they think about lady wisdom. They think about wisdom as something which is like a woman. It needs to be pursued. It needs to be held on to. And so when Paul talks about the idea of Sophia here, I think he has in mind both those folks in the tradition of Temple Judaism who understood wisdom about the scriptures to be something that was their possession, that was the result of an expert interpretation, and he had in mind folks like the Gnostics who said to know things, you had to be initiated into the secret. These were two kinds of people who would have been acquainted with the model of knowledge as Lady Sophia, as the idea that there was something that a master held, that there was a secret that someone needed to unlock. The message of the cross rocks the tradition that sees wisdom as the hidden possession of a private few. Because whether you define wisdom as a possession by inheritance, by ethnicity, or by membership in a privileged order, the message of the cross is this, that God is no longer hidden, that God is here completely and utterly exposed to the world, naked to the world in the public square. At the crucifixion, the curtain is torn and God is manifest in his humiliation on the cross, not only to be humiliated, but to be resurrected and to declare the glory of the kingdom that was to come. Faith, then, is not a possession of the wise. It's not something that someone holds because it is an insight that they have. True wisdom, the wisdom of the cross, is not hidden. The point of the death, crucifixion, and resurrection is that in the cross, in Jesus Christ, the true wisdom of God, the true wisdom of the kingdom, is laid bare for all to see. So much for the pretension that wisdom is the qualification of, or is the possession of an elect and qualified few. Against the parts of Corinth that would have asserted that, Paul asserts that our God became human, was born, died, and is resurrected. And in doing so, he declares to all the world the inclusivity of and the grasp of Christianity so that it include every person from every nation. And the message of the cross destroys those who have pretensions to discernment. This is a word that is terribly translated in our passage for today. The Greek word is sunesis. Okay? Sunesis is a word that the Greeks would have used if they were talking about a group of people running together. It's a word that in modern terms means something like being able to connect the dots. Sunesis is a kind of way of talking about knowledge that says, you ever met a person that's like, oh, I can see the whole better than anybody else. I know how things fit together in a way other people don't. I'm the kind of person who understands big and abstract concepts, and those big and abstract concepts give me a framework for understanding my world. I see how things fit together. I know what to do as a result of that insight. I can connect the dots. That is a person who has a claim to knowledge on the basis of sunesis. They get what thoughts run together. They understand how things fit together. The word here is not discernment like we think about it. Is something good or evil? Is it of the Lord or is it of something else? The word here is like the kind of person who says that they can see the way that things are interconnected. And you can see how this is something that would have been close to the way that the Greeks would have thought about the world. A person who had sunesis would have been a person who would have been healthy in beauty and body and mind and spirit. They would have seen the connections between those things. They would have seen how they worked out both in terms of theory and common sense. Sunesis. And the cross utterly reveals it to be nothing. The cross destroys sunesis because it declares that there is something utterly incalculable, utterly unbelievable from the perspective of common sense. That a Palestinian peasant and carpenter born of a virgin who lived 2,000 years ago, who embodied a God who was morally blameless, had to die so that he could miraculously rise from the dead to make the whole cosmos right. And he did it because then we can see a God whose infinity exceeds our rational capacities for calculation. The message of the cross is not exactly one that fits well with a notion of worldly wisdom or fits well with the notion of worldly knacks for knowing things or worldly calculation or common sense. The cross devastates tradition and common sense. For all the times when I was prepping the sermon this week, I saw so many, especially evangelical brothers and sisters, who would talk about postmodernism, and they'd say, aha, this is a rejection of the devil of postmodernism because it demonstrates that we have a choice between the cross or between the wisdom of the world. And I think that's a bad reading. I think in reading this passage, one of the things that we ought to think is that the cross ought to disrupt our certainty. The cross ought to disrupt the way that we think we know the world, that the cross serves as a kind of disruption of what it is that we think we are certain of. Think about Alice in Wonderland. If you're a Gen Xer, think Neo in the Matrix. If you take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. But if you take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. It's only partially tongue-in-cheek. The point of the cross and the resurrection is that we live day-to-day lives in an order that is about being a product of our preferences, our traditions, and our common sense. And the world we live in is great. The world we live in is very comfortable for us because it's predictable and we know how to move through it and we can expect what's going to happen tomorrow. And there are things that we know are certain to be in our future. There are things that we can predict and can know and can act upon. But the truth is, when we think about our lives that way, we understand our lives in a way that is fundamentally misguided. Because the order we live in is crappy. The order we live in is racked by sins of all kinds. Inequity, violence, hatred, greed, oppression, all kinds of things that are tough to even come to terms with. So how do we cope? How do we cope in our day-to-day lives in the context of living in a world where all these bad things happen? How do we do it? Well, we have all kinds of different approaches. We say, drink, eat, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. We say, live good, squeeze every bit of meaning out of life that you can. Find meaning in your family, find meaning in your tradition, find meaning in doing valuable work. And of course, there's what I think is the most intellectually honest answer, absent the cross, the one offered by the existentialist philosophers of the 50s and 60s who said, meh, why bother? See, the thing is, we work our way through the world on the basis of these strategies that say our world is held together for us, our world is predictable for us, we know what to expect, we have these anchor points, we know the way that things are going to go, we know how things are going to fall into place, we know that we need to live fulfilling lives. It's funny, we do that all the time, and we do it in spite of the fact that we live on top of an order which is premised on the work of sin, the work of death, it's premised on violence, oppression, it's premised on the devastation that came when the global order fell. We act and believe and think, even if we wouldn't admit it, that the end of our lives is in this mess to find happiness, to find fulfillment, to find our improvement, to maximize our opportunities, to optimize our preferences, to hold on to our tradition, to find comfort in our common sense. And here's the thing. If the end of your life is this little bit of self-deception that takes your tradition and your common sense and what is predictable about your world and what you feel secure with and what you feel safe with. If the point of your life is to reaffirm those myths for you to fulfill yourself, well, then there's this dirty secret, because there's a definition for a person who thinks that everything is about them. There's a definition for a person who thinks that everything is about maximizing their preferences, no matter how nicely or socially acceptably we say it. If your end goal is yourself, if your end goal is to maximize the things that you think you deserve, that you think you are owed, that you think you desire, that word starts with N and it ends with narcissist. We don't choose what God ordains for us. We can only respond to it with love. We don't choose what we are given, but the message of the cross is instead we suffer and embrace it because we have a faith that on God all things work according to the purpose of those who are called to Him. We believe that with God there is an end that is intended, and we do not choose it, but instead we choose to follow and to be faithful. And Corinth could not afford to think otherwise. Corinth couldn't afford narcissism. There was too much work to do. So Paul drives home this point about the character of the cross for them. And I have to be honest, I love this part. What does he do? He trash talks. That's what I love about this. He literally trash talks every part of Corinthian society which would have been considered to be learned or prestigious. Just think of him saying it. Don't read it like it's the holy text and have angels' voices in the background. Think about Paul literally talking trash. He says, talking trash to the Corinthian society that would have considered folks to be learned. He says, for those of you who think that your goal is to be properly self-maximizing, for those of you who think that your goal is to be, to quote Radiohead, better, fitter, happier, and more productive, those folks Paul looks at and he says, where are you at? Where's the wise one? Where's the ones who can connect the dots in the face of the cross? Where's the scribe who can write it all down? Where's the debater of our age who can talk about these ideas? In the cross, God has overturned everything that makes our human understanding of the world make sense. He has overturned the order of give to get, of cause and effect, of tit for tat, of work for reward, of punishment for sin. At the cross, the world is made anew. At the cross, the cosmos is reordered such that everything that defines the conventions of the human order that makes our life stable and predictable is shattered in the name of inviting us to come to a radical love that breaks every human convention and shatters every frame and every jot and tittle of human wisdom. Think about it. Think about how much we do to push off this realization. I'm not going to say that the project of apologetics is bad. I like it. I enjoy it. But if you think about it from this perspective, what a joke. What a joke to say that we need to justify the faith. The whole enterprise presumes that the truth of the cross is only acceptable if it can be translated into our terms, our traditions, and our common sense if we understand it. What a joke to think that it is in fact the narcissist, the textbook understanding, textbook definition of narcissistic understanding. Something is right if and only if it makes sense to me. We are not the ones who justify God. We are not the ones who prove the cross. God is the one who justifies. God is the one who decides. The message of the cross is not a justification. The message of the cross, Paul says, is a proclamation. The word he uses here is kerygmos. It's the word that the Greeks would have used for the loud bellow of a town crier over the noise of the market. That town crier literally does not care if the people in the market hear the thing he is saying, because he is ordained by the emperor to say it. The proclamation is valid not because it is understood. The proclamation is valid because it is ordained by the sovereign. The cross is not reducible to the proof. It is the ground of all truth. It is not subject to our tests. We are subject to it, and it is the thing that tests us in the logic of the cross, our lives are remade so that we understand that the things that God has given to us are not things that are about our preference, but that are about our destiny, are about being remade into an image that advances his kingdom, about being remade in a way where the cross reorients us and puts a demand on us. We could continue, Paul says, to demand signs. We could, right? We could ask for proof. We could subject the cross to our synesis. We could subject it to our tidy story about how the world works. But the cross isn't anyone's epistemological or metaphysical monkey. The cross doesn't dance. It's foolishness to those who believe in common sense. And that's not the main thing we Christian folk need to hear. I want to focus on the idea of it being a stumbling block. It is a stumbling block for, Paul says, the religiously inclined. And he's speaking specifically about the traditions of the Jews. He says it's a stumbling block for the Jews. It's a stumbling block for those who validate their world by relationship to religious tradition. And I think this word is just, I think it's amazing. Okay, so scandalon would have been in a like common usage the thing that like described a rock that was in the middle of the trail that you tripped over. Stumbling block, okay, that's not very insightful. But stumbling block, scandalon, was also the Greek word for the bait and the trigger of a snare. It was the Greek word for the bait and the trigger of a snare. It's a trap. The scandal of the cross is that it draws us in. It signals us to see its beauty, that we can grasp it, but instead of grasping it when we are remade in the image of Christ, the cross grasps and remakes us. The cross trips us up where we are. It is the reality that upsets our reality. It reorients us to a whole new world. It is the red pill. For Paul, the reason that the church in Corinth should take heart was this. Are you small? Yes. Are you besieged by stigma and dogma and discrimination? Yes. But that does not matter when you are snagged by his cross. Consider our call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak. The word there is asthenes, weak or unable to do anything great. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong, what is low to and despised in the world, the things that are not to reduce to nothing the things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. He is the source of your life in Jesus Christ, who himself became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, in order that the one who boasts, boasts in the Lord. And that's the thing, Resurrection Church. Christ and his death and his resurrection are not, and work with me here, they're not object of wisdom. They're not things to prove or figure out. They're not doctrines we believe. They're not just elements of our church dogma. They are, and he is, the cross itself is wisdom itself. And that wisdom should mess up your world. It should interrupt your ways of thinking about what for you is tradition or common sense or optimization or making yourself more excellent. It should take every element of you that has the sinful tendency to take your own intentions and baptize them, to take your own desires and plans and make them your own little idol, and that cross should shake them and it should shatter those tendencies. But in doing so, it will set you free. It will set you free to love God. It will set you free to love others. It will set you free to be and to know and to proclaim in a loud voice above the din of the crowd, Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Whatever you are tasked with, whatever you are challenged with, whatever it is that you think your life ought to be, the cross comes to you and it takes what is painful and it takes what is scary and it turns it into a resurrection and it says, I have a promise and I have a plan and I have a place. And the logic of the cross is that when we lay aside our own desires, when we lay aside our own hearts, when we lay aside everything which is to us our idol, which is our baptized intention, and we subject it to the foot of the cross, He will redeem us. He will become our righteousness. He is our wisdom. He is our horizon. He is the truth against which every idea ought be tested. It is silly to think that we can ask, is there an idea that we can use to justify or prove Him? The cross is the independent reality of history. The resurrection is the conclusion of it. And it shows that that God is with us. And if that God is with us, then who can be against us? If that God is with us, how can we not proclaim that He has become our wisdom? He has become our Sophia. He has become our principle of Sunesis. He is the cause, the explanation, and the end of the cosmos. He has come to make us righteous, to make us sanctified, to make us redeemed, to make us whole, and to make us healed. Amen. So we have a tradition at Resurrection to discuss for a while.